When it turns on, does it automatically launch, or did you just do that?
I just launched it. Okay. Yeah, people are coming in right now.
Well, welcome to everyone as you're coming in. We are going to wait just about another 30 seconds or so to let the population fill up. Happy good morning to you. And Susan Lambeau is already saying hello, so welcome, Susan. All right. Well, it looks like we've got almost everybody who's going to come in coming in. So with that, Hugh, I've already got a couple of questions that have popped up. Are you ready for your questions?
I'm all set. Go for it. All right.
The first one comes from Chris Thompson from Anchorage. And Chris says, a team of biologists from the University of Hawaii at Manoa and the French National Museum of Natural History published their study in the peer-reviewed journal Biologic Reviews on 10 January 22, where the research, including invertebrates, confirms that we're witnessing the onset of the sixth mass extinction in Earth's history. Could you please comment on the eschatological implications of these findings?
Okay, good question. To be clear, I've not read the paper, so I can't comment on the details of the paper, but a number of evolutionary biologists have been writing about what they call the sixth mass extinction, and some reference to what they call the big five mass extinctions, where we have over half the species of life on planet Earth going extinct at five different times over the past half billion years. And actually, those are crucial in order to compensate for the brightening of the sun. And as I pointed out in many of my talks, it's actually in scripture, Psalm 104. It's a property of all life to die off, but God recreates and renews the face of the earth. And this is a significant challenge to naturalistic evolutionary models because typically they don't take into context the fact that the sun does not give its constant luminosity. Its luminosity increases throughout its burning because its nuclear burning is fusing hydrogen to helium, which is increasing the density in the nuclear core of the sun. And that causes the sun to progressively fuse energy ever more efficiently. So the sun today is about 23% brighter than at the time of the origin of life on planet Earth. And how our creator has kept life abundant on planet Earth is periodically removing life from planet Earth and replacing with new life, where that new life is more efficient at drawing greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere. So as the sun gets brighter and brighter, atmosphere of planet Earth becomes less and less capable of trapping heat from the sun. The sixth mass extinction is a reference to humanity being the cause of the extinction of thousands of species of life on planet Earth. Because we're such a dominant species, consuming such a large fraction of the resources of planet Earth, it's basically squeezed out other life forms. And so we're seeing what they call the sixth mass extinction. And some are actually arguing this could be just as catastrophic as the big five that have happened in the past. And I don't know what this review paper is commenting on, but other review papers I've read on the sixth mass extinction are making the point that this one is quite different from the previous ones, and that it's targeting the more advanced species of life. And so it's the most advanced plant species and the most advanced animal species that are being impacted the greatest. And I think that's understandable, given the fact that we humans are particularly targeting those species of life to sustain our wealth and civilization. We shouldn't be surprised that, say, half the land mammals on planet Earth that were here at the time that God created Adam and Eve are now gone. When Adam was on the face of the earth, there were a little more than 8,000 species of mammals, and today there's only 4,000 species of mammals left. And this sixth mass extinction needs to be understood in the context of Genesis chapter 1. For 6 days God creates, on the seventh day he stops creating. So previous to God creating Adam and Eve, we have God creating new species to replace those that go extinct, or new phyla to replace those that go extinct, or new orders to replace those that go extinct. This being the seventh day, God has ceased from his work of creation. So all we're seeing are the extinctions. And we see a few natural speciation events, but it's at the species level, not at the level of families or orders or classes or phyla. God's at rest. So all we're seeing is a natural process of work. And because we humans are abusing our environment, because we're sinners, we're not really managing the planet the way God intended, that you see in Genesis 1, 28, 29, and 30. And so we shouldn't be surprised that we're seeing so many species go extinct. The latest research is also indicating that human population, wealth, and technology is now impacting even some invertebrates. Almost all the impact on animals previously that has been documented has been focusing on the vertebrates. But now there's evidence that human activity is causing some extinctions, significant extinctions, even of the invertebrates. So this is an issue. We need to be addressing it. But I think the context is what we see in Genesis chapter 1, where God put human beings in charge of the planet and all of its resources to manage these resources for our benefit and the benefit of all other life, which means God has provided us with the necessary resources and the solutions where we can manage the planet's resources for both our benefit, but also the benefit of all other life. And that's a theme that you see in Weathering Climate Change. It's a theme that will be brought out in more detail in my next book, Design to the Core. But keep in mind, sin does get in the way. And that when people are selfish, they tend to abuse their environment. It happens in our homes, happens at our offices, happens at the planet at large.
Thank you. We have another question from Keith Wilson. He says, I was thinking this week about your procedures to apply the scientific method and found them helpful. How would you formulate them as a universally applicable logical steps, or how would they be formulated for an engineer? He says that he found them helpful in planning his procedures for telescope build. Or how would you formulate them, especially as hermeneutical principles applicable to biblical exegesis?
Well, that's what we kind of covered in our class session last week. And hey, you can go to paradoxes.org and download it if you didn't have a chance to participate. But that was kind of my theme, is that this biblical testing method, also known as the scientific method, is indeed universally applicable. And so I would argue that theologians would benefit from following this method, just like scientists would benefit. It will help theoretical scientists as well as those that do observational and experimental work. And so I tried to give some examples last week, for example, of how it could be applied by theologians. You know, in science, we repeat our experiments. We do more observations. But what we can do in theology is look at other texts. I mean, the Bible is 66 books. And so, for example, we've got multiple opportunities to test our interpretations of Genesis 1 by looking at the more than two dozen other lengthy biblical texts that deal with the subject of creation. So in that sense, you really can apply this scientific method to theological research, engineering. I mean, again, I can recall being educated in Canada where we were told, hey, this works for artists. It works for literature majors. It works for engineers. It works for scientists. And a lot of the exercises that we did in our public school was actually, we were given the assignment, show us how you can apply this scientific method in disciplines beyond observational or experimental scientific research. It was a fun exercise. And hey, maybe that's a homework assignment we could give to everybody in the class. Hey, pick your favorite activity and show us how this scientific method could be applied, whether it be a knitting and crocheting club, whether it be producing, photographic art or painting or, engineering. Look at the different engineering disciplines, because obviously you're going to be applying this scientific method a little different way in, say, electrical engineering than you would in civil engineering. So this might be a fun assignment to give people in the class. I'd be more than willing to allow time for people to report on how they've been able to apply this biblical testing method. But the point I made last week is in Scripture, and the way it's stated in Scripture is to indicate this is something that can be universally applied. And the challenge is, okay, use your minds and your spirits to figure out how that would work out. But I remember going through that even in my public school education.
Thank you. We have a question from Doug McComb. And he says, good morning, Dr. Ross. How do you interpret Matthew 24, 32 through 35, the lesson of the fig tree? What does the fig tree symbolize, and what is and when and how long is the generation referred to? A lot of people still interpret it to say the fig tree is the nation of Israel. Others say it's the kingdom of God. What say you?
Well, I mean, those are both possibilities. And a lot of people, literally for a couple of thousand years now, have been speculating about what did Jesus mean by the fig tree. And many interpreters say, note that there's a previous passage where he looks for fruit on a fig tree and can't find any fruit. And he winds up cursing the fig tree, and the fig tree withers. It's probably that passage that gets people thinking, he must be referring to the Jewish kith or to the people of Israel, the nation of Israel, and that this was a prophetic thing that he did, kind of like what you see in the Torah, where you got Moses striking the rock. And the second time he strikes the rock, God rebukes him, saying, hey, and the context is, I set this up as a prophetic event, and you messed it up. And so that's why God had to rebuke Moses, because he was intent that this would be a teaching lesson. And so people, and you notice the disciples were wondering, hey, what's going on with this fig tree that our Lord cursed just because he couldn't find figs on it? What's the message here? So they knew there was a sermon behind his actions. So that's the basis of people speculating that the fig tree either refers to the blood descendants by Abraham and Jacob, or maybe the nation of Israel. And the reason for that is history documents that the Jews were dispersed throughout the world for almost 2,000 years. They were without a nation, without a country. And they said that seems to fit the story of Jesus looking for fruit on the fig tree. And the whole context is God established Jews and Israel as a means to communicate God's message to the nations and peoples of the world. And that was the figs that they were supposed to produce. And since there were no figs, since the Jews and the nation of Israel had failed in their mission to take the message of salvation through what God is offering to all the people groups of the world, this is why they were dispersed for this period of time. And again, you can read in the Old Testament where you even have Moses predicting that this dispersal would happen. The diaspora was actually predicted in the book of Deuteronomy, that they would be scattered to all the nations of the world for many, many generations. But there was always the promise God would bring him back. And so the rebirth of nations in Israel, many look at that as a fulfillment of that. But Doug is right. There are other interpretations about what that fig tree means. And again, now it says, when you see the figs coming back. And so this has led to some interpretation that generation will not pass. Well, what does it mean about the restoration of the fig tree? Is that referring to the birth of the nation of Israel in 1948? Is it referring to that time when the nation of Israel got control of the Old Testament prophetic sites, the high places, including the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. That would be 1967. Is it referring to the time when the Jews will actually be back in their mission of taking the good news of salvation to all the people and groups of the world? In that case, the generation has not yet started. So there's a lot of debate going on today about when that generation begins. Is it 48? Is it 67? Is it yet in the future? And how long is that generation? Is it the generation that the Jews spent in the wilderness, which was 38 years? Some say 40 years. Is it referring to the time between being born and being able to reproduce, which would be about 20 years? Or is it referring to the typical lifespan of a human being, which would be 70 or 80 years? Or is it referring to the maximum lifespan, which would be 120 years? So Doug, there's a lot of different options and how you can interpret that text and how you can interpret the generation. And so a lot of people looked at that text to try to establish a date for the return of Christ. You know, this generation shall not pass and Christ will come back. But hey, when does a generation begin and how long is that generation? The one thing I think we can confidently conclude from that, it's likely not going to be more than 1,000 years in the future. It's going to be less than that. And maybe we're talking something on the order of less than just one or two centuries. So in that sense, I think it's fair to interpret that text. We're looking at the soon return of Christ. And I think that's appropriate because we're relatively close to fulfilling the Great Commission. And in Matthew 28, Jesus said he would return when we who are his followers bring people to faith in Christ and make them faithful disciples. So they not only come to Christ, they become disciples, where we see a significant fraction but that taking place in every people group of the world. That Great Commission is not yet finished, but for the first time in human history, it's achievable in a single generation, however you want to define that generation. So I mentioned before in this class, Christians today, evangelical Christians, have got the financial resources, they got the technology, and they got the people to fulfill the Great Commission in less than a decade. All they lack is a motivation. But for 2,000 years, we've seen that Christians have had a lacking in that motivation. But now that it's close, maybe this is a time we can all step up and make it happen.
Okay, well, we have 8 more very, very good questions, but we're right now up against the time frame where you would start the webinar. So I'll leave it up to you.
Well, let me get the webinar started, okay. The message, and we'll have another time for Q&A after I'm done with my 30 to 35 minutes. So we'll get back to those questions.
Good.
And we'll do it like we did last time. We'll take about half the Q&A time in the webinar that we're in right now, and then we'll segue to the web meeting where it can be a little more personal, where we can turn on our cameras and on our microphones.
Okay, so when you're done with the webinar, then we'll go back to the Q&A questions that we have pending right now.
When I'm done with my message, we'll go back to the questions.
Good.
And we'll stay in the webinar for a period of time.
Great.
But I think people like the fact that we continue the Q&A into the web meeting. So that's why we've extended the time window for the web meeting. Great. Okay, I'm going to begin with an announcement. A lot of you asked me questions about Bill Craig's video clip that he posted where he was critiquing what I wrote in Beyond the Cosmos. And thank you for alerting me to that. I actually visited and watched the clip, both the short version and the long version. And if you actually go to the Reasonable Faith YouTube channel, you'll see that I posted a comment. Basically making the point, hey, this is actually in the book. And again, making the point that I did not get to choose the subtitle of Beyond the Cosmos in the first edition. It was not published by RTB Press. It was published by Nav Press. And I didn't get to choose the title or the subtitle. But now that it's under our copyright, now that we have the rights, we've put out a third edition in which we changed the subtitle from the extra dimensionality of God to the transdimensionality of God, and was clear in all three editions of the book that I wasn't claiming that God was constrained to the dimensions that he created. Yes, he created more dimensions in the four we experience, but it's a God that's both immanent and transcendent. He fills and operates everywhere within the dimensions he creates, but he's not constrained by those dimensions. The space-time theorems, which I gave a whole chapter to in the book, makes it clear that God is the author and the creator of all the dimensions that exist. And so, of course, he can't be subject to those dimensions. Incidentally, I explained that to William Lane Craig, Bill Craig, 25 years ago. And I'm coming up with a blog on Monday on March 28th, and which I actually give the historical background to this misunderstanding that both J.P. Moreland and Bill Craig have had about the book. And I actually, we've had on our website for 25 years the full written dialogue between me and J.P. Moreland and Bill Craig. And so it's on our website. I give a link where you can see not only the written exchange between me and Bill and J.P. and also Tom Oden. Tom Oden was involved in that. But you also get to see an introduction to the dialogue written by another theologian. And then Millard Erickson kind of wrote a postscript. All six articles are available in full on our website. And so when the March 28th blog comes out, you'll be able to see the whole historical development about what's been going on. But yeah, it has concerned me that this is continuing to be misunderstood. And by the way, I do give credit to Bill Craig, because what happened in the meeting we had 25 years ago, he says, "Hugh, I missed this when I went through your book. I know it's repeated. Please repeat it many more times." And so we kind of went overboard in the second printing of Beyond the Cosmos, where we made it abundantly clear over and over again, we're speaking about both the extra dimensionality of God and the transdimensionality of God. And of course, we change the subtitle. So hopefully that'll take care of that. You can go to his site and see the brief paragraph I posted, but you'll see a blog coming out on March 28th. Hey, I got something brand new I've prepared. I've been asked by my bosses, which is our board of directors, if I could be preparing more talks. And I've actually got about new talks I'm developing. And they said, well, get four of them ready to go. Well, this is one I'll be presenting later this year at a conference of philosophers. But it's a question that's come up frequently in my social media, my Twitter and my Facebook pages. And it's a question I'm getting at events. And so we're thinking it's important to develop this. And so it's a two-part talk. I'm going to give half of it today and half of it the next time I'm with you. And then we're going to try to polish it up. I always appreciate feedback I'm getting from you that are members of the Paradoxes class, but you're going to be the first to hear the draft of this talk. And I'm going to polish it up for a public presentation later. So with that, let me share screen. And this is also a good example of a talk that features dual revelation, because what I'm going to do in this talk is basically begin with what the Bible's got to say on this subject, and then what we have from the science, and then we're actually going to end with what the biblical implications are for this. So this is just the first slide indicating I do take questions on Facebook and Twitter. And we do have a 24/7 YouTube channel. This is the URL you're going to need to get into the web meeting that we'll have after the webinar. and it's in the web meeting where you can turn on your microphones and cameras. And yes, we'll continue the Q&A time, but I'll actually be able to see you and respond. And it's also a chance for you to get to know one another and to testify of a meaningful spiritual encounters you've had in the past week or two. But this new talk is basically addressing this question. Are we alone in the cosmos? And I've actually got books in my office with this title, Are We Alone? They're written by astronomers who are not Christians, but they're addressing this question from a purely scientific perspective. Are we alone in the cosmos? And what they mean by that, are we the only intelligent, civilized, technologically advanced species within the entire universe? Or are there others? Is there any validity to, say, Star Trek or the Star Wars movies that are out there? Is it possible that there are other civilizations out there, other physical beings with a capability of launching civilization and technology? So what I'm going to do is begin what the Bible's got to say about this. And by the way, this is not a new debate. Scientists are debating it. That debate began the 20th century and the 21st century. And it was in the 20th century that the effort to search for extraterrestrial intelligent civilizations began. The SETI project, SETI stands for Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, has been going on for 50 years now. And it's considerably well-funded, both privately and with public funds. But this is a debate that's been going on in the Christian community since the first century AD. So it's been going on for nearly 2,000 years. And what I want to do is just show you the context for this Christian debate and what the Bible's got to say about this debate. Then we're going to look into, okay, what do we see in the book of nature that gives us insight to this debate? And then I want to close, what does this mean in terms of eschatology? And that's where I think we get the most interesting application from the subject matter. A lot of people just simply think about it in the context of what scripture says about the past. But I think the theologically more important question, what does this debate mean in terms of the future of humanity, the future of the universe, and what does it tell us about the doctrine of the new creation? So that's kind of where we're going in this talk. But let me begin with, what does the Bible got to say about this subject? The only passage I know of in scripture that puts any constraints on the debate, is there intelligent life elsewhere in the universe, is what you see in Hebrews 9 and 10. And I'd recommend reading the entirety of both chapters, but here are probably the most significant passages in Hebrews 9 and 10 that deal with the subject, where it says the priest had offered, and the priest is referring to Jesus Christ. He is our high priest. So it says this priest, referring to Jesus Christ, had offered for all time one sacrifice for sins. By one sacrifice, he made perfect forever those who are made holy. And so where people have looked at this text for some insight on whether or not there's intelligent life elsewhere in the universe, as they look at Hebrews 9 and 10 and says, this text, it certainly implies, or if it's not even explicit, that Jesus Christ, the creator of the universe, came to one planet and made one sacrifice at one time for all. And so many have interpreted that would imply the planet Earth is the only place in the universe where you got physical, intelligent beings capable of launching civilization, but also who are in need of redemption from their sins. And so this wouldn't eliminate the possibility of God creating bacteria on another planet, or creating grass or trees, or even cows and horses and whales, or even people like us that have no need for a redeemer because they've never sinned. This would only put a constraint on planets elsewhere in the universe where you got people like us. And then there's scholars have jumped in, theologians are saying, well, wait a minute. this is Jesus Christ, the creator of the universe. Who says that this one sacrifice he made here on planet Earth couldn't atone for the sins not only of all of humanity, but the sins of every other spiritual, physical being that exists elsewhere in the universe? Although most theologians say that's a bit of a stretch, because these other sinners that could conceivably exist elsewhere in the universe would not have had a personal visit and a sacrifice made right in front of them. It wouldn't be the same as what we've experienced here on Earth. But that gives you some idea of the speculation that's going on. And it's something that was recognized even by the first century Christian church, that the Bible really doesn't put much of a constraint on what kind of life exists elsewhere in the universe. And there's been two sides to this debate. One side of the debate, you've got theologians who look at different creation texts in the Bible, and particularly they see what God has written in Isaiah and in Psalms, and saying, as we look at these different creation texts in the Bible, Genesis 1 included, the book of Job included, it seems like God really enjoys creating. And moreover, he seems to want to create at a maximal level. And so you've got passages like what you see in Psalm 104, where it says, how many are your works, O Lord, and wisdom you made them all. The earth is full of your creatures. And if you read the entirety of Psalm 104, it's basically saying that God has packed our planet with as much life as the laws of physics will permit, with as great a diversity as those laws would permit, basically making a point, no matter where you travel on Earth's surface, go down to the bottom of the deepest oceans, climb the highest mountain, you're going to find life that God has created. Life is everywhere. It's even in the underground part. If you go down to the bottom of the ocean and drill down to the seafloor, even thousands of feet deep below the seafloor, you will find life. Life is everywhere. God has packed the planet with life. And our theologians have said, well, if God's doing this for planet Earth, why wouldn't he be doing it for the universe? Just like he packed our planet with as much life as possible, wouldn't he also be packing our universe with as much life as possible? And you got passages like this one that you see in the book of Isaiah, where it's again referring to the earth. He did not create it to be empty, but formed it to be inhabited. And so again, we have this concept of God filling earth with as much life as conceivably possible. And therefore they said, well, this may sounds like a principle that would apply to the entirety of the universe. And therefore the expectation is we're gonna find God creating life everywhere throughout the universe. Now it's what's interesting when you read this debate, and by the way, the debate was especially fruitful in the Middle Ages. It was during the Middle Ages where you really had a lot of Christian scholars debating this issue. But what's interesting about the debate is that 100%, at least those that we have where we got writings from them, said if life exists elsewhere in the universe, it's not going to be because that life spontaneously appeared. It'll be there because God specially created it, just like he did here on earth. So that's one thing you see in the Christian debate, was a recognition that if there's life beyond planet earth, it's gonna be there because God designed those bodies in the same way he designed our galaxy, our star, our sun, our moon. You're gonna see the same kind of supernatural designs. Natural process is not gonna be able to explain life elsewhere in the universe. It'll be there because of God's supernatural intervention. Now, where the debate has matured a bit in the 20th and 21st century is you've got Christian scholars saying, you know, I think God must create life elsewhere in the universe because he anticipated that we human beings would eventually develop the technology to search and find that life. And because we already know from our research on the origin of life, that this can't happen naturalistically, the discovery of life elsewhere in the universe will exponentially increase the evidence for God as a creator. because they're going to realize, hey, it didn't happen just once. It happened multiple times. These would be multiple evidences for God's supernatural interventions. In fact, I remember having a friendly debate with some Christian scholars who took that view back in the 1980s and 1990s and saying, well, wait a minute. Not every scholar today concedes that the origin of life is a supernatural event. You've got many researchers and saying, you know, given the sin of humanity, the pride and the autonomy of humanity, even if we find multiple sites in the universe where there's life on it, don't be surprised if you've got scientists and a lot of their followers saying, well, I guess nature just spontaneously made it happen multiple times. They're not necessarily going to conclude that this is additional evidence for God's creation intervention. And again, just look at Romans chapter 1, which makes the point that we humans in our sin, in our autonomy, have this pervasive habit of instead of crediting the creator, we credit the creation. So we say, look what nature did, rather than saying, look what the creator did to produce all of this. Okay, that's one side of the debate. The other side of the debate is saying, we think, based on what we see in scripture, that we are alone in the universe, that there is no other place in the universe where you got intelligent, physical, spiritual life. And they will point to instances in the Gospels where Jesus was pressured to perform miracles and he refused to perform those miracles. You know, an obvious example is you see in the Gospel of John, where you've got Jesus, the miracle of the loaves and fishes, where 5,000 men and their families were fed from the lunchbox of a small boy with a few loaves and fishes in it. And what happened was when Jesus left that area, crowds followed him because those crowds were anticipating, hey, he'll do it again. I'm not going to have to work for my food. I just have to follow Jesus of Nazareth and he'll perform these miracles. And, we'll have, and so they were following him looking for him to perform a miracle. And what we see is that Jesus quickly figured out what they're up to, saying, the only reason you're following me is that I fed you and you're anticipating I'll perform another miracle to feed you. That's not why I did the miracle. There was a message in that you overlooked. You didn't see the message. And so what he does in John chapter 6 is basically explain to the crowds the spiritual significance behind the miracle that he performed. And it was a miracle designed to bring repentance, not to fill their bellies. And so he explains this to them. And therefore he says, I'm not going to do the miracle you want me to do because you didn't understand the spiritual significance of the miracle I did. So he said, not going to do that miracle. And then we have another example. This is in the book of Luke, where we have Jesus arrested and he's about to face crucifixion. And what we see there is that he winds up being cross-examined by the high priest. And then Herod gets to cross-examine him as well as Pilate. And so Luke is the one that gives the most extensive report of the cross-examination of Jesus. It's the only one of the Gospels that talks about the cross-examination by King Herod. And basically what it tells us there is Herod was eager to cross-examine Jesus because he wanted to see Jesus perform a miracle right in front of him. And Jesus flatly refused to perform the miracle. What's a couple of examples? There's others that we could talk about in the Gospels, but it's these Gospel texts that has caused Christian theologians for the past 2,000 years to say, hey, there's another side to this debate. It seems like what we see in the Gospels, not just the Gospels, you'll also see it in the Old Testament, where God refuses to perform miracles that that people want to see, basically making the point. There seems to be this biblical principle that God performs as few miracles as are necessary to achieve his stated purpose. And so it's basically the point that God does not perform gratuitous miracles. He only performs the miracles that are necessary to achieve his purpose or his purposes. But this leads to another debate. What are the purposes of the Creator? Is it his purpose to have just one species of physical spiritual beings on one planet that hears and responds to his message of redemption from their sins? Or is there a larger purpose going on? And what about the angels? It tells us in the Bible the angels are watching what's happening to us human beings on planet Earth. Are they exclusively watching this planet and other planets, or is there more going on here? But the whole point is, for 2,000 years, Christians have debated whether or not extraterrestrial life exists. And scientists are mistaken in thinking that the discovery of extraterrestrial life would be devastating to the Christian faith. Basically, they're thinking this: if we discover extraterrestrial life, that'll be proof that it happens spontaneously and naturally. But Christians for 2,000 years have said, no, if we find life elsewhere, it's going to be more evidence of God supernaturally creating that life, as opposed to it be happening naturalistically. And the scientific debate we see in the 20th century, we don't even have a scenario naturalistically to explain the origin of life here on planet Earth. And if it happens somewhere else, it's going to be an even more dramatic miracle, because it's already clear in astrobiology, the easiest place to have a naturalistic origin of life is here on planet Earth. It's going to be far more challenging elsewhere. And hey, even here on planet Earth, we don't even have a scenario, let alone a hypothesis or a theory about how this can happen naturalistically. I'll say more about that in a few minutes. But the whole point is, neither the existence or the non-existence of extraterrestrial life has any significant bearing on any of the crucial doctrines of the Christian faith. So this is where atheist scholars are mistaken. In fact, that came up in the debate I had with Peter Atkins in England, where he was presuming if we do find extraterrestrial life, that will be the end of the Christian faith. And so I just had to share with them, no, hey, Christians have been dealing with this issue for 2,000 years. And Christianity does not rise or fall on the discovery of extraterrestrial life. Although, as I've already mentioned, some Christian scholars argue the discovery of extraterrestrial life would actually enhance the evidence for the Christian faith and God's supernatural intervention, because it would show that God has supernaturally intervened, not just on one planet, but several planets. Okay, I'm going to spend the rest of my time today looking at what we see in the book of nature, and I'll probably get about halfway through this, then we'll pick the rest up next time, and then we'll look at the eschatology that's implied by what we see in nature's book. So what does nature's book say? What does the scientific record say about the origin of life? And I'm going to begin first about what it says about primitive life. Then we're going to look at what it has to say about advanced life. And by primitive life, we're talking about microbes. For the first 3 billion years of the history of life on planet Earth, it was microbes only, a very diverse ecology of microbes, but it was microbial life exclusively for the first 3 billion years. And I've written in my book, Improbable Planet, why it's not possible to have anything other than microbial life for the first 3 billion years. It actually takes 3 billion years of microbial life activity to prepare the planet for large plants and large animals, and in particular for human beings. But when it comes to the origin of life on planet Earth, there are six factors that rule out the possibility that it can happen naturalistically. So I'll go through these one at a time. First being is, the origin of life on planet Earth did not happen over a long period of time. It was a very short period of time. I took a course from Carl Sagan when I was at the University of Toronto, and which he discussed the origin of life. And his model at that time was, he said, there's this vast prebiotic soup, basically referring to the oceans of the world. And at that time, the oceans covered the whole surface of the earth. So we have this huge water pool that's filled with prebiotic molecules. And his comment was, if we have this huge ocean of water over the surface of the earth filled with prebiotic molecules, if you give it a billion years, those prebiotic molecules by chance will bump into one another, assemble more complex molecules, and eventually produce a very primitive life form, a small, tiny bacterium from which that in turn evolves to all life on planet Earth. The problem is that billion years is not correct. We now know that the origin of life occurred on planet. We got isotope evidence establishing that not just one species, but multiple species of microbes are present on the Earth 3.825 billion years ago, where the error bar in that is as small as 0.006 billion years. So we're talking just a 6 million year time window, because that 3.825 billion years ago is the first time that conditions on the primordial Earth became stable enough to allow the proliferation of microbes over the whole face of the Earth. There is a possibility you might have had a single microbial species existing for a brief period of time before that, but only one region for a brief period of time. There is no possibility for ubiquitous microbial life until 3.825 billion years ago, but it's at that time we actually see evidence for abundant life, which tells us life showed up spontaneously, suddenly, immediately upon the face of the Earth. It didn't happen over a billion years. It happened over a short period of time. Furthermore, we see that Carl Sagan was wrong about this vast ocean filled with prebiotic molecules. We have isotope evidence telling us that there were no prebiotics on the Earth. The isotopes tell us we see the evidence for postbiotic building block molecules, but we don't see the evidence for prebiotic molecules. There are no prebiotics that show up in the isotope record. And so if you don't have any time and you don't have any prebiotics, you don't have a naturalistic model for the origin of life. And it was many years ago, back in the 1990s, when Fuzz and I attended an Origin of Life research conference, where we got to hear Romanian physicists explain why there were no prebiotics on the face of the Earth at the time of the origin of life. And he basically laid out what's now referred to as the oxygen ultraviolet paradox, which is the idea that if you've got oxygen in the atmosphere and the oceans of the Earth, that oxygen is catastrophic to prebiotic chemistry. That oxygen is guaranteed to prevent the development of complex biomolecules. This was evident in the Urey-Miller experiment. Probably heard of that. It's in all the high school textbooks, where you got, Urey and Stanley Miller had this flask where they had different kinds of molecules, and basically methane and ammonia, and they had some nitrogen in there and carbon dioxide, but no oxygen. They recognize even the tiniest amount of oxygen in the flask stops the development of even the simplest of the amino acids. And so they kept the oxygen out. Oxygen's catastrophic. But if you don't have oxygen in the atmosphere, in the ocean of the Earth, you've got nothing to stop ultraviolet radiation, short ultraviolet radiation pouring in from the sun. It takes oxygen to establish an ozone shield about the Earth, which prevents the short wavelength ultraviolet radiation flowing in from the sun to the surface of the Earth. If you don't have any oxygen, you don't have an ozone shield. Not an ozone shield, that ultraviolet radiation pours through, and that ultraviolet radiation, just like the oxygen, prevents the development of these molecules. So you've got a lose-lose scenario. If you have oxygen, it can't happen. If you don't have oxygen, it can't happen, which basically kills a naturalistic pathway. And then the other problem we see here, there's no solution to the homochirality problem. In terms of trying to build RNA and DNA, RNA and DNA is assembled by taking the nucleobases and joining them together through ribose sugars. But it only works if all the ribose sugars are right-handed in orientation. They're not 100% right-handed. You're not going to be able to join together these nucleobases to make DNA and RNA molecules. And likewise, you're not going to be able to join together the amino acids to make proteins unless the amino acids are 100% left-handed in their configuration. In the natural world, ribose comes at a 50-50 mixture, random mixture of left and right-handed. Likewise, the amino acids show up as a 50-50 random mixture of left and right-handed amino acids. And the last Origin of Life research conference Fuzz and I attended at the University of California, San Diego, homochirality was the big theme of that conference. And basically they showed the only naturalistic pathways to homochirality would be through sources of ultraviolet circularly polarized light, where that light preferentially destroys the right-handed amino acids more efficiently than the left-handed amino acids. But all the highly controlled lab experiments I did basically proved that yes, this will move you towards more left-handed amino acids than right-handed amino acids, but it's done through destroying the right-handed more efficiently than left-handed, but you wind up destroying the left-handed amino acids. And long before you get to 100% left-handed amino acids, you've got no amino acids left at all. In fact, they weren't able to penetrate the 80% barrier, even where they got a huge store of amino acids under highly controlled laboratory conditions. They basically said, by the time we get to 80%, there's no sample left. And no matter how big a sample you start with, if you project to 100%, there's nothing left. So that's a fundamental barrier. And also at that same conference, they devoted a day to saying, do we understand where the building block molecules come from? How do we get these amino acids? How do we get the ribose sugars? How do we get the nucleobases? Because one of the things that is evident is that when you look at the sources where these molecules can be assembled, basically interstellar molecular clouds, I'm confident these molecules are being constructed there. The problem is those same interstellar molecular clouds, you got chemical mechanisms that are destroying these molecules almost as efficiently as they're being constructed. And so we've yet to find a single amino acid in an interstellar molecular cloud. We have found them in comets, but we've not found them in an interstellar molecular cloud. That's where comets come from, these interstellar molecular clouds. We've yet to find a nucleobase. We've yet to find a 5 or 6 carbon sugar. But I'm on record, we will find them. We will find them because we know the chemistry operates in those clouds. But we're going to be finding them at a part per billion or less. And only in the last year and a half have we developed the astronomical technology to measure abundances of these molecules at a level of a single part per billion or a little bit less than a part per billion. So it's just going to be a matter of time before we discover these molecules. But if we're finding them at no more than one part per billion, this is of no value to any Origin of Life scenario. That's way too dilute a mixture of these molecules. And I love what was said at that conference where they had 5 experts speaking on this subject. They all agreed on this one thing. Not only do we not understand where the building block molecules come from for life, we don't even understand where the building blocks or the building blocks of life molecules come from. And then finally, the first life form is no way as simple as what Carl Sagan said when I took that course from him. He was thinking maybe we could have a simple bacterium with only 300 or 400 gene products. While we do have bacteria that have as few as 450 gene products, but they're parasites. They can't live on their own. They get by with only 450 gene products because they feed on more complex microbes that have got 1,500 or 4,000 gene products. So they can't live on their own. In terms of an independent microbe that can survive on its own, we know both theoretically and experimentally that the minimum number of gene products is 1,400. And so that's a very complicated microbe and far too complex to enable any naturalistic scenario. And this, by the way, is a problem not just for life on planet Earth. As I mentioned earlier, it's easiest on planet Earth. But if you go to Mars or if you go to some speculated extraterrestrial planetary system, you got the same problem. You got a problem with time, and you got an additional problem you don't have on planet Earth. It's called the carbonate crisis. For life to exist, you have to have water and carbon dioxide. But the problem is, except for planet Earth, that carbon dioxide and water will chemically form carbonates. And so very quickly, this is what happened on Mars and what happened on Venus. Is yes, they began with liquid water and carbon dioxide, but because those planets did not have powerful, long-lasting plate tectonics, which we'll discuss next week, what happened was the liquid water and the carbon dioxide reacted, formed the carbonates, and the planet wound up with no liquid water and very little carbon dioxide. So that's called the carbonate crisis. And also, if you don't have a powerful, enduring plate tectonic activity, there's no way you can have a magnetosphere. And without a magnetosphere, there's nothing to stop the radiation from the star penetrating to the surface of the planet and basically destroying all the prebiotic molecules. And no matter where you go in the universe, you're going to have the oxygen ultraviolet paradox, and you're going to have a problem with homochirality. Those happen everywhere. And then you also got the problem, where are you going to get the building blocks? The fundamental source is these interstellar molecular clouds, but we already have astronomical evidence. Yes, these clouds do make the necessary building blocks of the building block molecules, but they produce them at a concentration level that's so ridiculously tiny, less than a part per billion, it basically prevents any naturalistic pathway for the origin of life. Bottom line here is that they even were talking microbial life elsewhere in the universe. The only way you're going to have that microbial life is if God supernaturally intervenes. Natural process is not going to explain the existence of even the simplest life, even microbial life elsewhere in the universe. It will require a supernatural intervention. If you want to read more on this, we have the book called Origins of Life. And by the way, the new edition of our book, Origins of Life, when we put it in 2014, has two places within the book, a URL to a database of articles that Fuzrana and I have written on the origin of life since we brought out the book. And that URL takes you to over 200 articles and video clips that we've produced on the origin of life since we brought out the book, basically making the point, the more we learn about the origin of life scientifically, the greater the evidence we accumulate that it must be a supernatural event. It can't be a naturalistic event. Okay, I'm going to stop there. So next time I'm with you, we're having a conference at Reasons to Believe, so I won't be here next week. But next time I'm with you, we'll do part two. And yes, again, I appreciate your feedback because this is a talk I've been asked to give not just once, but a few times in 2022. And I'm hoping to make a kind of a two-part series. So we'll see how that goes. So I'm going to stop the screen share here. And we'll take questions while we're still in the webinar.
Great. looks like there's 8 or 9 questions that are open here, Hugh, so we don't have much time. So please do your best to keep it tight. So the first one comes from Tom Wee from Germany. And his first question is, can you indicate what are the views on climate change held by other science faith organizations and what discussions are taking place? Do you have any further anecdotes of persons sharing their faith through implementing your suggestions on reducing global warming?
Well, really good question. That's actually going to be a major theme at the Evangelical Theological Society conference this coming November. What they're doing is they're inviting Christians who have written on this subject to kind of have a dialogue slash debate on this. So I've been invited to make a presentation. Catherine Cahoe, who's much more better known on this than I am. In fact, I think she's in the list of the 50 most influential scientists in the world, and she's dedicated her life to this climate change issue. So she'll be presenting and dialoguing with me. And we got two others that are going to be, and they purposely picked four of us that hold quite different positions on how do we deal with climate change. The common denominator is none of us are climate change deniers. We realize that, hey, we've had this long period of stable climate, but it's being threatened by the particularly aggressive human civilization we have today. But we're going to be presenting very different responses to this climate change debate. And you know what I'm going to be presenting, and it's basically in the book, Weathering Climate Change, is that there's a way to stabilize a climate where we enhance the world economy rather than cripple the world economy. At the same time, we actually enhance the ecosystems of the world. So it's basically presenting win-win-win solutions. We benefit, other life forms on planet Earth benefit, and we stabilize the climate at the same time. But I can assure you, the other presenters are basically making the point, this is such a critical crisis, a crisis of such magnitude that we need to institute immediate laws and taxes penalties for people who don't immediately do what's necessary to stabilize the climate. So my position is this, I do agree with them, this is a crisis, but that when you try to solve the crisis with penalties and taxes and laws, you actually slow down the response because people are going to resist. They're saying, hey, I can no longer drive my automobile and you're going to want to punish me for consuming any carbon. And they're going to say, I'm not going to do it. And so people will cheat and they'll refuse to obey the law. And that's going to slow down our capacity to really deal with the problem. My point is give people an appropriate economic incentive and you won't need any laws. You won't have to have punitive taxes. You won't have to have what are called subsidies, where you say, well, we're not going to tax people, but we're going to give all this money to people who do what we want to do, regardless of the economic outcomes. So it should be fun what happens there in November. I'm looking forward to it.
Okay. Let me see where our next question comes from. Comes from Mark Durham, who says, please comment on the Ukraine-Russian war and if it foreshadows the predicted Ezekiel 37 through 38 Gog of Magog war.
Yeah, interesting from Mark. And, you know, it was Hal Lindsey back in the 1970s and 1980s who identified Magog that you see in the book of Ezekiel as a Soviet empire. And actually says, we actually see in Ezekiel all the allies of this Magog. It's countries like he claimed Turkey, East Germany, Eastern Europe. And he wrote a book, The Late Great Planet Earth, in which he said, you're going to see the Soviet Empire become militarily more powerful, gathering all the allies. And he kind of looked at the Table of Nations in Genesis 10, to identify the allies of a Magog, which would include Iran and Turkey, Afghanistan, and all of the Eastern Europe that was behind the Iron Curtain, and said, this is Magog. And so there are people who are his followers and others are saying, if he is correct, then the Soviet Empire must be rebuilt. And so they're saying, hey, this is the beginning of the return of the Soviet Empire. You know, they've already taken control of Georgia. They've taken control of Chechnya. Ukraine is next. They've got Crimea, and they're going to go after the Baltics. They're going to go after Poland and East Germany, get control of Turkey and Iran. All that's going to happen. This all assumes that he is correct in identifying Magog as Russia. I do make a point that Hal Lindsey does point out passages in Ezekiel that says the armies of Magog will come from the north. So that's where I think he gets his idea that it's got to be this the Russian Empire, because it says that this huge army from many different nations in a coalition come together and invade Israel from the north. And he said, well, what's north of Israel? The farthest north of Israel is Russia. But again, there are many other scholars are saying, we don't think he's correctly identified Magog. Nowhere in the Bible does it explicitly tell us who Magog is or who the people of Magog are. And trying to use the Table of Nations to identify the allies of Magog, that's difficult because, and I would agree with this, that in the Table of Nations is talking about people groups, not geography. And so how do you identify the peoples that are mentioned in the Table of Nations with the geography? Because people move and they colonize. And so where the people were in the land of Turkey originally, where are they now? And so that becomes an issue. So this is open for debate.
Great, thank you. Tim Williams says, what's the state of acceptance or rejection of Penrose's cyclic cosmology and its claims of correlated circles in the cosmic microwave background?
Yeah, and I think people need to understand Roger Penrose. Number one, he has declared on BBC television that he's a theist. So a lot of people have identified himself, Roger, as an atheist or agnostic. And I give a citation in the Creator and the Cosmos fourth edition, where he said on British national television that he believes, I disagree with my colleague Stephen Hawking. I'm not just a deist. I think there's purpose in the universe. The universe screams purpose, which indicates that he believes in some personal entity beyond the universe that created the universe. But we also need to understand he's a mathematical physicist. And as a mathematical physicist, he likes to engage in so what mathematical research. What if? And so, you know, people say, well, Roger, you're contradicting yourself. You said this in one paper, and they said, well, hey, I'm just playing with the mathematics. I'm not saying I necessarily believe all of this stuff. I'm saying, if we make this assumption, this is what can happen. So, for example, he's been writing papers on the cyclical universe, where he talks about the mathematics that would be necessary to explain a contracting universe that contracts down to a singularity and then leads to an expanding universe from that same singularity. But years ago, and this is documented in a debate he had with Stephen Hawking, a marvelous debate, by the way, a very friendly debate. It's where Stephen Hawking and Roger Penrose at Cambridge University said, let's have a course at Cambridge, where we trade lectures. You lecture for one period, I'll give the next lecture, you give the next one, I give the next one. So it was a back and forth debate that went on for a whole semester. And the core of the course was God, eternity, and time, and cosmology. And so they're going back and forth in that. And they take questions from the people in the audience, the graduate students and professors that were in the audience. And this is where, and I cite this in the Creator and the Cosmos fourth edition, where Roger was put on the spot by one of the attendees of the course saying, well, we talk about these cyclical universes. Do you think it's actually feasible that this could happen? And his response was interesting. Mathematically, yes. physically know. He says, yes, you could have a contracting universe that contracts down to a singularity. You can have an expanding universe that expands from a singularity, but you're not going to be able to join the geometry of a contracting universe to the geometry of an expanding universe. And it's something that I wrote about in Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men, why there can't be wormholes. Wormholes, again, as Roger Penrose would point out, are mathematically possible, where you've got a black hole with a singularity and another black hole with a singularity. You could have the two singularities of the two black holes perfectly touch one another, which means you could travel from one space-time realm, go into black hole A, go through the wormhole where the two singularities touch one another, and come out in a different space-time realm. That's what a wormhole is. Mathematically possible, physically impossible. Why? The probability that you're going to get the two singularities, and keep in mind a singularity is an infinitesimally small volume. So you've got this infinitesimally small volume perfectly touching and joining the infinitesimally small volume of a different black hole. The probability of that happening is zero. The probability of it remaining stable is also zero. Even if they were to perfectly touch one another, they would not remain in close contact for any significant period of time. So wormholes are not physically possible. What's that series on TV, Babylon 5 or whatever, was built on the theme of a wormhole. That's not possible. And likewise, it's not possible that a collapsing universe gave birth to an expanding universe. But again, as a mathematical physicist says, hey, this works mathematically. And I'm just showing you how it could work mathematically.
Okay, thank you. So Von Mancha says in Psalm 104, the Holy Spirit repopulates the world. Many biologists think transposable elements, or he puts in parentheses junk DNA, can shuffle to form new species. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, that does work for microbes, even there with limitations. The idea that this is going to work to give a new phylum of animals, that's the stretch. And this is something that James Valentine and Irwin, trying to think of his last name, wrote in their book on the Avalon and Cameron explosions, is that, yeah, these appeals may work at developing a variant of a species. It's not going to produce a new order. It's not going to produce a new class or a new phylum. And moreover, you got the problem. This was not addressed by Valentine and Irwin. But the fact is that we see these mass extinction events in the fossil record on a periodic basis. They happen about every 30 to 35 million years. Adrian Malott has written a number of papers. He's an astrophysicist demonstrating the periodicity. But he and his team have also given an astronomical explanation for the periodicity. Namely, every 33 million years, the solar system goes through the plane of our galaxy. I mean, the sun is on a quarter of a billion year orbit around the center of our galaxy. But as it's going around the center of our galaxy, it's going up and down on the z-axis. And it goes, as it goes up and down cyclically, it passes through the plane of our galaxy once every 33 million years. And when you go through the plane of the galaxy, you've got a high probability of having a close encounter with a giant molecular cloud. And when that happens, it destabilizes the five comet and asteroid belts. And that's something we see with the big five, what they're called the five biggest mass extinction events in the past half billion years. They all correspond to times when we go through the plane of our galaxy. And all five of those mass extinction events can be attributed to either a giant comet or a giant asteroid impacting the Earth and igniting volcanic eruptions all over the planet. It used to be a big debate. Are these mass extinctions a result of a collision event, or are they the result of volcanic eruptions? We now know they're related. If you get a big enough asteroid or comet hitting the Earth, it will puncture through the crust and basically ignite volcanoes all over the planet. And this explains why you get 50% plus of all species of life on planet Earth going extinct. The challenge, as James Valentine and others have pointed out, is how do you explain the mass extinction events? How do you explain them happening so soon after the mass extinction events? And how do you explain the fact that it's not just a few species of life suddenly appearing on the planet of Earth? We see new orders and new classes and phyla appearing on the face of the Earth. This is the big challenge. And so, yes, you can appeal to things like gene exchange, and you can appeal to things like epigenetics and mutations and natural selection. That may be helpful in explaining a variant of a species. It's not going to help you explain where a phylum comes from. And as Valentine and Irwin have pointed out, when you look in detail at the fossil record, the thing that really challenges naturalistic explanation, we do not see the proliferation of species leading to the proliferation of higher taxa. The higher taxa appear first. The phyla appear first. They appear suddenly. And much later, you get the proliferation of species. It's the opposite of what you'd expect from these naturalistic mechanisms to drive change.
Thank you. Colby asks, could you please elaborate on your claim that you made that in a minimum of 5 years, we could share the gospel with enough people to go into the new creation? What do you think would follow that if we accomplished that?
Well, where I get that 5 to 10 years from is from my friend. And, you know, he was a member of the Paradoxes class while he was alive. He's passed away, and that's Ralph Winder. He was the founder of the U.S. Center for World Missions. And he was the one that wrote a book and several online articles that made the point that if Christians worldwide would invest 1% of their income in the fulfillment of the Great Commission would be fulfilled in just one decade or less. And I agree with him, having gone through his book. The problem is the level of commitment financially to the fulfillment of the Great Commission by Christians is at the 0.1% level. So we're a factor of 10 away from the 1% that Ralph Winter talked about. And so the challenge is, how do we motivate Christians to invest at the 1% level? And he said, hey, they're at a 10th of a percent. Going up to 1% is not that big of a deal. But I remember having a dialogue with Ralph saying, here's the problem. The vast majority of evangelical Christians give zero towards the fulfillment of the Great Commission. Those that do give are giving at a level of 3 to 6% of their income. Challenging those that are committed to go from 3 to 6% to 30 to 60% is not realistic. We have to find some way to motivate those people who are giving zero. Now, this was some 15 years ago that we had this dialogue. What encourages me, because what was happening back then is that, you know, we were leading all these people of faith in Christ in Africa and Latin America and Asia. But the churches there were not investing in reaching people groups beyond their own. They're doing it now. And so we're seeing a significant missionary movement taking place in Africa and in Asia, to a lesser degree in Latin America, but I got hope it'll happen there as well. In fact, that's one of the goals of Reasons to Believe, is to launch a Reasons to Believe Latin America, where we really begin to target, how do we motivate the Christians there to reach out to the STEM people throughout Latin America? And so what can we do to bring evangelism into the life of those people there who have a commitment for doing that? So, there was a second part to that question, Mark, something about the future.
Yeah, I think what you answered the question, which is what is it that makes you think that that's going to occur, that we could actually achieve that? And what do you think would follow if we actually accomplished that? Would that bring in Jesus' return?
Well, that's the whole point, is that Jesus promised, as soon as we fulfill the Great Commission, he's coming back. And if you have a premillennial perspective on end times prophecy, that would mean that Jesus would personally reign here on planet Earth for 1,000 years. And after that 1,000 years, the universe will fulfill this purpose, God will speak it out of existence, and we all get to go to the new creation. Post-millennialists will say, hey, as soon as the Great Commission is fulfilled, we right away go to the new creation. But either way, it happens fairly soon. Whether it be right away or 1,000 years, you get there fairly soon. But the real measure of when these end times prophecies are going to be fulfilled is all based on how are we doing as believers in Jesus Christ at taking the good news of salvation to all the people groups of the world, where we make a significant fraction of those people groups disciples of Jesus Christ. I write about this in Improbable Planet, basically making the point it's within reach. We literally could do it in a single generation. And we're already at a level where we're between 15 and 18% of the world's population that could be classified as disciples of Jesus Christ. Jesus himself said it would never be a majority. But if you look at the book of Zechariah, at least with respect to the Jews, it's at the one-third level. And so if we take that for all the people groups of the world, it's certainly within reach. It can be done. And I agree with Ralph Winter, of all we can do is just simply boost the investment up by a factor of 10. We'll have the job done in a decade. However, I also am recognizing that's a big challenge. Motivating evangelicals worldwide to increase their investment by a factor of 10 is not going to be an easy task.
Great, thank you. Tinny Washington says, there seems to be a large overlap between the UFO and Bigfoot communities.
Yes, there is.
Yeah. So do you think there are these phenomena are negative spiritual influences, as you mentioned in the Little Green Men book, or are they completely biological phenomena, or are they hoaxes, UFOs and the Bigfoot claims?
Well, you know, my story is, and you'll see this in Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men, I had no intentions of ever becoming an expert on UFOs. It happened at age 16, where our astronomy club booth was right next to the Flying Saucer Club booth at the Pacific National Exhibition. And that kind of followed me everywhere I went, because I was one of these rare astronomers that was actually an amateur astronomer before becoming a professional astronomer. And see, amateurs that really know the night sky well. And so I always got the job of processing these reports. But what I saw starting at age 16 is just like you have all this UFO phenomena going on, you got the Bigfoot phenomena going on. And hey, I was raised in coastal British Columbia, and they called it Sasquatch. And so that's the name they had in British Columbia for Bigfoot. But yeah, that's kind of the story of Bigfoot, that you got this man-like creature bigger than we are that's wandering around in these rainforests. And I also remember that when I was at the University of British Columbia, the Undergraduate Engineering Society took great pleasure in pulling off UFO hoaxes and Bigfoot hoaxes. They did both. So it's not surprising we see a correlation in the hoaxes, but also a correlation in people thinking, hey, maybe there's something supernatural going on. Maybe there's something demonic going on. But I can tell you, there's zero physical evidence for Bigfoot. It's kind of like the Loch Ness Monster. You got a lot of blurry photographs, but no tangible physical evidence. And you know, one thing I remember the Undergraduate Engineering Society did, they took the biggest undergraduate student they had. He was 6'8" and weighed 300 pounds. And the students actually designed for him a Bigfoot outfit, a Sasquatch outfit. So he wore this big furry suit, and they equipped him with plywood shoes that were 2 feet long. And they had him tramp around the snow just above in the mountains above Vancouver. Took lots of photographs of him tramping around the snow and leaving these giant footprints. And it took a year before it became exposed as a hoax. The newspapers picked it up. So yeah, the engineers had a lot of fun with that hoax.
It's about 5 minutes to 12. We have two more questions. Do you want to go through the questions or do you want to start your webinar?
Well, if they're short, we'll take them. If you think they're going to be involved, I'll move them into the web meeting. What do you think?
I think at least the first one, you could probably get done pretty quickly. It's, what do you know about the facts that humans like old world apes can't make our own vitamin C, but most animals and new world apes can? Her daughter seems to think that this supports an evolutionary link to the old world apes.
Yeah, I've actually got a chapter I'm going to be writing fairly soon in the book Undue Revelation, where I address that question. It's already addressed in her book, Who is Adam? Basically making a point that it's a superior design that we do not manufacture vitamin C. It's a good thing that we don't manufacture vitamin C like a lot of other mammals do. And it's essential if you're going to have a primate that lives several decades that they don't manufacture their own vitamin C. Animals that manufacture their own vitamin C have to manufacture a lot of vitamin C because the body throws it off. And so you're basically saturating the organs in those animals with lots of vitamin C. And over time, that does damage. And so I would encourage anyone to beware of these online articles that say you need to be consuming 30,000 units of vitamin C a day. That's way too much. If you consume that much, it will do long-term damage, particularly on your brain. It's actually going to cause the small capillaries to begin to bleed. Now, if you're only going to live to be 10 years, no big deal. But if you want to live to be 80 or 90 years and still have a sharp functioning brain, then you have to avoid having that much vitamin C circulating in your body. And, you know, although we don't make vitamin C, we do have a circulatory system. And so what's unique to humans and the large primates is that, and guinea pigs, is that these are animals that have designs to recirculate small amounts of vitamin C. So the creatures that make their own vitamin C don't have that. It's unique to those animals that don't manufacture their own vitamin C. They have these design mechanisms that efficiently recirculate the small quantities of vitamin C that they take in through their diet. So yeah, we consume vitamin C in our diet, but our bodies are designed to recirculate that in a very efficient way so we can survive on a low level of vitamin C, which allows our brain to be able to function at a very high level for many, many decades. And that's crucial because we humans have this huge brain, and that brain needs to be able to function at a very high level for a long period of time. So the fact that we don't manufacture vitamin C, that's a good design. It's not a bad design. If you want to see all the biochemical details about the recirculation, you'll find some articles at reasons.org written by Fuzz Rana, and it's also in her book, Who is Adam?
And the last question is, do you know what percent of the total electromagnetic spectrum life depends on?
Well, I would argue we need it all. And, you know, in terms of just looking at what we need here on planet Earth, yeah, you can get by with the visible part of the spectrum. We do need ultraviolet radiation. There's several biochemical reactions that take place in all life forms, even bacteria, that will not function if there's not long wavelength ultraviolet radiation coming through. We need the infrared that provides us with the heat. And I would argue that in terms of getting the elements we need for advanced life, you need the full range of the electromagnetic spectrum. I explain that in quite a bit of detail in my next book, Design to the Core. So, in terms of what we need immediately, we can get by with only a tiny fraction of the electromagnetic spectrum, but you need the whole of the electromagnetic spectrum in order to explain why we have the different components we need in the universe for life and why we can actually fill out the periodic table. To fill out the periodic table, you need the whole range of electromagnetic radiation operating to get them at the just right levels.
So this part of the spectrum that life depends on is, you say, directly, if we're talking about just for sustainment of life on Earth.
Well, you're going to need the visible light. That's for the photosynthesis. You're going to need at least the long wavelength ultraviolet light to generate some crucial biochemical reactions for life. And you're going to need the infrared radiation to get the heat that we need. And people say, well, there's an all-loving God. Why all this gamma radiation? That's the really deadly stuff. But it's that gamma radiation that makes the heavy elements, the R-process elements that we see in the periodic table. That's half the elements that are heavier than the element iron. You're not going to get that if you don't have those very short, deadly wavelength radiation. So you really do need the entire electromagnetic spectrum in order to get everything we need for life.
Okay, that's the last question.
Okay, well, I see that it's noon, so we're way past the time to go into the web meeting. Those of you who can join us, I'm going to pop up the URL again. So let me share a screen. And we'll go back here.
It's also posted in the chat.
It's posted in the chat. It's also posted at paradoxes.org. And here it is up on the screen. This is the URL you're going to need to get into the web meeting. And when you get into the web meeting, be patient. I'm going to need a minute or two to pull you in because you'll be put into a waiting room and I'll have to manually move you into the web meeting. But as soon as you're in the meeting, turn on your cameras and your microphones. That's an option. I know some like to participate in the meeting where they don't turn on their camera. That's fine. That's your option. But you definitely have the option to turn on your camera and microphone. And we'll take some more questions during that time. But it's also a time for us to get to know one another and share significant stories about what has happened spiritually in our lives. I got some stories I can share, but I think you've got stories as well. As it tells us in Scripture, we need to encourage one another daily with what the Spirit of God's been doing in our lives. So as God has done something amazing in your life and helping you share with another individual, I'm going to give you an opportunity to do that, a brief opportunity to do that. So with that, I'm going to stop the share feature, and we will end the webinar. And those of you who can join us, see you in the web meeting. And we'll go for about 30 minutes in the web meeting.